From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
One of the strategies of these conservative funders is that they're really multiplying the number of institutional voices at all levels of government that are carrying the same core set of policy messages. And they're building incredibly strong institutions, awarding unrestricted money to institutions like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute.
A look at how conservative foundations shape public policy. Are the campaign finance hearings racist, or is that just White House spin control? And internationally renowned filmmaker John Pilger on Cambodia. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations War Crimes Tribunal sentenced a Bosnian Serb to a 20-year prison term for his part in an ethnic cleansing campaign against Muslim civilians during the Bosnian War in 1992. Dusan Tadic, a former police reservist and bar owner, was sentenced to a total of 97 years on 11 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes, but the sentences will run concurrently with the longest single term. He was convicted on May 7th. Documents in a Texaco race discrimination lawsuit were hidden not to avoid losing in court, but because company executives did not trust their own lawyers, at least that according to an investigator. Michael Armstrong said at a news conference yesterday the motive was not we better take this out or the company will lose the lawsuit. The motivation was distrust and hostility towards lawyers and the whole process. Two Texaco executives face obstruction of justice charges in the document controversy, which arose out of a lawsuit minority employees filed against the oil giant, alleging discrimination in hiring and promotion at Texaco. The company endured a boycott before settling the suit last November for a record $176 million. Armstrong, the lawyer hired by the company to determine what happened to the documents, said he found a file carefully labeled documents withheld from legal containing the papers in question. Meanwhile, after just one meeting, the president's advisory board on race has had a difference of opinion over the very type of problem it was assigned to help resolve, centuries-old tensions between African Americans and whites. The board decided yesterday to open its year-long study of race in America with an examination of the impact racial views have had on education and economic opportunity, and vice versa. But it did not reach an agreement on how much weight it should give to relations between black and white Americans, which the board chair, John Hope Franklin, said has acted as a roadmap for relations between whites and other races and ethnic groups. He said this country cut its eye teeth on black-white relations. Without knowledge of the past, we cannot wisely chart our course for the future. In Louisiana, a group of women's health care providers filed suit in U.S. District Court yesterday to block enforcement of a new state law charging doctors with a felony if they perform so-called partial birth abortions. The suit, filed just hours after Louisiana Governor Mike Foster signed the new proposal into law, claimed the law's definition of, quote, partial birth abortions is so vague that it could be applied to commonly accepted methods of abortion such as the dilation and evacuation method, as well as the more controversial dilation and extraction method. The suit also claims the law prevents physicians from exercising their best medical judgment for their patients, and in some cases, the threat of prosecution could force doctors to use methods that may impose unnecessary health risks on women. The suit seeks an immediate restraining order. No ruling was issued. California Governor Pete Wilson signed a state law yesterday to bar the use of foreign funds in elections on ballot measures. Wilson said in a statement, while federal law prohibits a foreign national from contributing in an election for any political office, it's silent on the issue of initiatives, referenda, or recall elections. The bill, by California State Senator Quentin Kopp, an independent, bars foreign governments and individuals from contributing to campaigns for or against state or local initiatives. And also in California, in Los Angeles, a growing flotilla of cargo ships sat at anchor in the port early yesterday, unable to dock or unload as 11 harbor pilots remained off the job in a strike supported by dock workers. Eight ships were at anchor Monday afternoon. The pilots struck late Friday after negotiations with the city of Los Angeles broke down over a proposed wage increase. The dock workers refused to cross picket lines that went up at terminals after ships were docked with non-union pilots over the weekend. With death rates dropping and people with AIDS living longer, the challenge now is finding money to care for those living with the disease, according to advocates. The bad news is more medical providers are being caught in a revenue crunch with no money for the flood of patients who now need outpatient care. This according to Dr. Victoria Sharp of St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in New York, where, says the advocacy group AIDS Action, more and more poor people simply cannot afford the expensive drugs that promise to prolong their lives. The drug combinations, which include the powerful protease inhibitors, cost $15,000 per person every year. The just-completed NATO summit gave the appearance of being the final step needed to add Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic to the Western military alliance. It wasn't. The legislatures of all 16 NATO allies must approve the new members, and a no vote by any one would kill NATO expansion. A two-thirds majority, 67 votes, will be needed in the Senate to approve the expanded treaty alliance. Senator Dick Lugar, Republican of Indiana, leading advocate of the expanded alliance, said yesterday the problem with predicting the outcome of the NATO debate is that lawmakers have not focused on the issue. In international news, the annulment of the citizenship of an Israeli-born television station owner in Peru brought a wave of media and public protests against the Peruvian government yesterday. Several thousand people staged a demonstration outside the offices of Frecuencia Latina in support of its owner, Baruch Ivker, who was stripped of his Peruvian citizenship on Sunday. The protesters, including journalists, pensioners, students, and opposition leaders, waved placards saying, "Down with the dictatorship and long live press freedom." The government canceled Ivker's citizenship, saying there were irregularities in his application forms. But journalists said that it was discrimination by the Peruvian president. Some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic fundraiser John Huang may have had a formal relationship with his ex-employer during his tenure at the Commerce Department and the Democratic National Committee, this according to Republican investigators. Setting the stage for today's resumption of Senate hearings on campaign finance abuse, the investigators said the former employer, the Indonesia-based Lippo Group, close to the Suharto dictatorship, considered Huang an advisor 2 years after he left there. The Senate Governmental Affairs Committee sources, if not quoted by name, said they had obtained a registration form for a March 1996 World Bank conference in which Huang was listed as a Lippo advisor. A key question before the committee is whether Huang, a key figure in the Senate's fundraising investigation, used his international trade position at Commerce to provide sensitive information on China to Lippo. The conglomerate has major Chinese investments and has a partnership with a company owned by the Chinese government. It has previously been disclosed in news stories that John Huang kept in touch with Lippo officials at the same time he received classified briefings in his Commerce Department job. However, those contacts did not indicate he maintained formal ties to his former company. Huang left Lippo in the summer of 94, worked for Commerce beginning in August 94, and began employment at the Democratic National Committee in January of 1996 as chief fundraiser in the Asian American community. Joining us now is two people in our Washington studio, Karen Narasaki, Executive Director of the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium, and we're also joined in New York City by Max Sujanata, an Asian American pastor serving an African American congregation in Mount Vernon, New York. He is an Indonesian pro-democracy activist. We're going to talk today, before the hearings get started today in the second week of the campaign finance abuse hearings, about the issue that has been raised over the last week by Asian American groups of racism at the hearings. Karen Narasaki, let's begin with you. What are your feelings about this?
Well, we've been concerned for a long time that given the focus on a few fundraisers who happen to be Asian American, that the hearings could slide into stereotyping, which in fact is what happened on day three when we had Senator Brownback from Kansas using pidgin English and sort of mimicking Asian immigrant speech when he was talking about John Huang.
What about overall your attitude toward the hearings? I mean, do you think that there is a legitimate issue here to investigate, just simply the issue of campaign finance abuse, both by the Democrats and the Republicans? And with the focus on Democrats, it does seem to be the latest focus. And today, for example, will be John Huang.
Yeah, well, clearly the issue about campaign finance and the huge amounts of money that flow through the system and the corrupt influence that can have is a very legitimate topic. Also, just the issue of whether John Huang or any of the other people who were accused of doing something inappropriate or even illegal, you know, that is also fair game. But what we've been concerned about is that it not be targeted in an inflammatory way. We've been concerned about the focus on whether there was Chinese influence or not. That's an important issue, and we're not saying it shouldn't be looked into, but we're saying particularly because it could be racially inflammatory, the senators have to be very careful in how they approach that subject.
Max Sujanata, you are an Indonesian, a pro-democracy activist, Indonesian-American, I should say. You're also a pastor here in the New York area. What about your take on the campaign finance hearings and the focus on fundraising in the Asian-American community?
I agree with what the lady had said before. I am dismayed at the tenor of this hearing, which takes on an Asian American bashing. I mean, it is as if we try to scapegoat good citizens, loyal citizens who knew Americans, who were trying to contribute to the American system. And yet, they are subjected unnecessarily to a racist stereotyping, which I find very deplorable. I agree that we need to examine whether there is influence peddling, particularly when we see the connection between Huang and Lippo, and Lippo directly to the Suharto family, who is one of the richest family in Southeast Asia. So we need to stay clear about what we are really trying to investigate. And having said that, we also need to be very clear about us, how our government has done influence peddling in other nations during elections in other countries. And so, I mean,
certainly that is an issue that has been commonplace over the years, that many Americans have not questioned, everything from the Nicaraguan elections to the Chilean elections to many other places in the world. But let me ask you, Max Sujanata, on the issue of Asian American bashing, racism in these hearings, it's also something that President Clinton raised early on. One of his defenses was, you're attacking a community here that, you know, is a very important part of the melting pot of what is America. But was this a way to deflect criticism from the U.S. government's relationship with the Indonesian regime, with the Chinese regime as well?
Unfortunately, knowing our beloved president, I have to say that this is one way of deflecting the issue, unfortunately. Because we really need to be clear what did John Huang do? I mean, and what is his connections? Or what was the background of all these Clinton visits with Riadis and his close connections with Riadis?
That's James and Mokhtar Riadi, who head up the Lippo conglomerate.
That's right. So if we really want to investigate, let's get everything out.
We're also joined in the studio in Washington by Bob Sakaniwa, who heads the Japanese American Citizens League, which is the largest membership Asian American organization, civil rights organization in this country. Your take on these hearings, Bob?
Well, Well, thank you for having us here, first of all. And I just wanted to follow up on a point that Max is making, which is a very important point, and that's to keep clear in everybody's mind what we're saying as advocacy groups, civil rights groups, watching what's going on, and that is we're not trying to use Asian bashing or China bashing defense to defend any particular individual who is currently being investigated, but rather it's our concern that these hearings and the way they're portrayed will have an effect on the community, and it's that secondary effect that we're monitoring very closely. And when we hear statements like Senator Sam Brownback's statement mocking and mimicking in broken English statements that could easily be attributed to a person with an Asian accent, well, that's a serious concern, and you have to wonder if, you know, if he was mimicking any other ethnicity, you know, what would have been the reaction? And we know in our community, our reaction may be internalized a lot, but I wouldn't count on that type of internalization to continue, because I know there's a lot of anger out there, and we hear about it every day from the affiliates and contacts we have throughout the country.
I think it's an important point that while President Clinton or the Democrats may be using the Asian bashing to try to deflect some attention, that still doesn't take away from the fact that there is a real concern. And that's one of my worries, is that in the cynicism over what the Democrats may be doing with the whole Asian bashing issue, that the fact that there is real potential for that, in fact, realized potential, that will be lost. And that's a huge concern. My organization tracks anti-Asian violence every year, and we've seen the impact of these kinds of statements. You know, on top of the anti-immigrant sentiment that was just flourishing over the last couple of years, now we have this return of sort of the fear of foreign, the fear of China, and as China and some of the other East Asian countries rise in economic and military presence, that's going to continue to put pressure on how that impacts Asian Americans here. And we just want people to be clear on making the distinction between what's going on with foreign governments and what's going on largely in the Asian American community.
You know, one of the things you don't hear President Clinton talking about when he talks about racism are threats to Asians. Perhaps one of the greatest threats to Asians, particularly Indonesians, the fourth largest country in the world, is the Indonesian dictator himself, is Suharto, responsible for the killing of perhaps between 500,000 and 1 million Indonesians themselves in 1965 when he came to power, not to mention one of the proportionally largest genocides in the 20th century, the killing of the Timorese, starting in 1975 when Indonesia invaded. So that's something you don't hear President Clinton talking about, is that if you're going to talk about attacks and on Asians and discrimination against Asian Americans and Asians as well, is taking on one of his closest allies as the dictator of Indonesia and attacking, you know, and criticizing him if he's concerned about Asian welfare.
Well, I think you also put your finger on the whole idea of context to this whole situation. Right now, we are just focused on not even a handful of players, but one person in particular, John Wong, and what did he know and what did he do? When really, from a domestic angle, what we're concerned with is campaign finance reform right now, and we see a lot of the problems coming from the soft money influence that was so prevalent in our last 96 election cycle. And that doesn't begin to go into the issues you're talking about regarding international issues and how governments interact and deal with each other. But the kind of basic fundamental question of money and access is something that I think is getting lost in this focus on one particular player in this, and we have to keep in mind there's a much broader context to this whole issue.
Karen Arasaki of the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium, how are you monitoring these hearings?
Well, we have a coalition of Asian American organizations are sending in people to actually watch the hearings. As you know, they're not being covered in live time on most of the stations. So it's kind of a challenge because of the amount of interest. They rotate people in and out, so you need to be able to sort of have a small army in order to do that. We're also very connected through internet with Asian Americans around the country who are watching this with huge interest. I just got back from Houston and from Fresno, and the first question I get whenever I travel is, you know, what's happening and how badly is the Asian American community going to be hurt by these hearings?
How can people get in touch with the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium?
Well, they could call us at 202-296-2300, and our internet address is hn5598@handsnet.org. People can plug in and see what's going on. We try to do a daily briefing.
That's 202-296-2300, or you can go to the internet at hn5598.handsnet.org. And let me ask you, Bob, if people want to get in touch with the Japanese American Citizens League, where can they call?
We can be reached at area code 202-223-1240, and my email address is dc@jacl.org.
That's 202-223-1240. Well, Bob Sakaniawa with the Japanese American Citizens League, Karen Narasaki of the National Asian Pacific American League Consortium, and Max Sujanarda, Indonesian American pro-democracy activist, I want to thank you all for joining us. When we come back, we're going to take on another issue in Asia, and that's the issue of Cambodia. After that, we're going to look at conservative foundations and how they're influencing public policy in this country. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. New Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen this past weekend invited international scrutiny of his regime's human rights record and pledged to hold a free and fair general election at an unspecified date. The latest public relations move follows the bloody ouster of Hun Sen's co-prime minister, Prince Norodom Ranariddh, last week. And it appears to be working. International criticism is tapered, and King Norodom Sihanouk, who is Prince Ranariddh's father, signaled that he would accept Hun Sen's sole authority in governing Cambodia. The latest political shakeup in Phnom Penh represents a rupture with the political status quo established by tens of thousands of UN troops and $2 billion in 1993. Promoted until recently as one of the few UN peacekeeping success stories, the Cambodian operation followed a peace deal in the early 1990s between the Vietnamese-backed regime and guerrilla forces, including the notorious Khmer Rouge, backed by the United States, China, and Thailand. We're joined now by John Pilger, a journalist and filmmaker based in Britain. He produced the first film exposing the genocidal program of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia during the 1970s. It was called Year Zero, followed up by Year One after that. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John Pilger.
Thank you.
Well, before we talk about events of today, I think to make sense of it, we should go back a couple decades to understand particularly the U.S. relationship with Cambodia and how things got to where they are today. Can you take us back to the 60s?
Okay. I think the present Cambodia's present agony really has to go back to 1969 when President Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger bombed Cambodia. This was unconstitutional. It was kept secret from Congress. The logs of the B-52s that were sent over Cambodia had were falsified. The aim was to wipe out North Vietnam's supply line through Cambodia. And in 1970, this was followed up with a land invasion by the then Saigon Army, backed by the U.S., and the bombing continued. You have to understand the scale of this bombing and the effect it had. In one period, in 1973, for example, the equivalent of five Hiroshimas in tonnage were dropped on Cambodia. And what we've since had is declassified CIA files, which state quite clearly that the bombing really provided the catalyst for the rise of a hitherto unpopular, or barely popular, radical organization called the Khmer Rouge, led by Pol Pot. So out of that devastation, and something like 750,000 Cambodian people were killed during that period, the Khmer Rouge were able to build a state within a state and then expand that. And finally, in 1975, year zero, as Pol Pot called it, they took over. And they were in power until Christmas Day, 1978, when the Vietnamese, who had been attacked over a period of 2 or 3 years by Pol Pot's forces across their border, retaliated and drove Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge administration into Thailand. Now, there the story pretty well could have ended. Pol Pot and his gang and the rest of them would have withered on the vine, as it were. But that wasn't to be so, because the U.S. was still smarting from its defeat in Indochina. It was policy to undermine, destabilize the Vietnamese government, the Vietnamese regime. There was an embargo against, blockade against Vietnam conducted by the U.S. This, of course, extended to the regime that the Vietnamese put into power in Phnom Penh when they drove the Khmer Rouge out. So the two countries were really subjected to this. Now, the Khmer Rouge became an instrument of that policy under the ancient maxim of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Khmer Rouge were effectively restored by the Western powers, led by the U.S., with a lot of non-government organizations helping, some of them wittingly, others not so, to the point where the Khmer Rouge became a force again, and a coalition was established. And in that coalition was Prince Ranarid, the person you mentioned in your introduction, the son of the now King Sihanouk, then Prince Sihanouk. Prince Ranarid was the so-called non-communist side of the Khmer Rouge, of the Khmer Rouge-led coalition. And diplomatically, militarily, they both had support from the U.S. They began really a war against the Vietnamese and its Cambodian ally in Cambodia itself. This ran up to 1989 when the Western powers returned directly to Cambodia under the UN flag, and that's when the UN so-called peace operation that you mentioned came into play. And they, out of that, came a really disastrous situation, because the Khmer Rouge were given under the they signed the UN peace charter, then refused to have anything to do with it. But in the meantime, they were given effectively something like a quarter of the country in which to really roam around with impunity. And and elections were held in which Prince Sihanouk, now King Sihanouk, was a really a major figure. And a lot of people voted for the royalists because they looked on King Sihanouk as a sort of semi-god, somebody who would take them back to the old days, pre the 60s of really nothing much happening in their country. So the royalists won, not by much, but they won, and they were led by Ranarid. Now, the UN concocted this idea of a two-headed government with Ranarid and Hun Sen, who had been... Hun Sen, incidentally, had been part of the Phnom Penh government allied to the Vietnamese. So you had two opposites, two diametrically opposed people politically and in terms of their own ambitions running the government. And that's all fallen apart in the last few weeks. So really it's, what is happening there now is the continuation of Cambodia's agony that, as I've seen it over the years, has been substantially, if not primarily, caused by outside and Western intervention.
We're talking to John Pilger, journalist and internationally renowned filmmaker based in London, produced the first film exposing Pol Pot called Year Zero, did that around 1979, and then followed up with other films and articles on Cambodia. I think it might surprise some of our listeners to learn that the United States supported Pol Pot and supported the Khmer Rouge, John.
Well, the flag was never run up saying we are supporting Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. In fact, we used to deny it a lot, but, it's only when it's officially denied, usually, that you know it's true. With my own experience in that part of the world and the experience of many others, there was no question that that the U.S. was directly supporting the Khmer Rouge. For example, in 1981, Dr. Ray Klein, who is deputy director of the CIA and on President Reagan-to-be's foreign advisory team.
Famous for Iran-Contra also.
Iran-Contra. Well, I mean, you know, same people, same plan all over the world. He went into... he had a secret meeting with top Khmer Rouge people. He may have met Pol Pot, I don't know. But he certainly went over there as an emissary from Reagan. And really, from the moment the Vietnamese kicked out Pol Pot, much to the relief of the population who put aside all their traditional animosities towards their neighbor, I know, because I was there just after it. I mean, it was a country truly liberated, like a Belsen liberated. Once that had happened, the U.S. wasn't having anything to do with this situation, and sought to, if not to reverse it, and put Pol Pot into power. That was never the aim. It was to use Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge to get at the Vietnamese to restore in Phnom Penh the kind of chaotic, indebted, free market, I suppose, administration of the kind that existed just prior to Pol Pot taking power. And basically, that's what they ended up with after the UN peace operation in 1993. The problem was that they put together this impossible double-headed government, and so it's fallen apart again.
What has happened to Pol Pot? The reports of him being killed, the reports of him being captured?
Well, none of these reports have any verification whatsoever. There isn't a single one with a proper source. It is the most extraordinary media hype that I can remember for a long time. It's here, it's over there with you, it's all around the world. I understand people's interest. Pol Pot is another Hitler, Stalin. He's a demon figure, and he rightly deserves to be so. But his friends, he did it with a lot of friends, including a lot of very powerful and so-called civilized governments as well. And it would certainly be a great day to find him captured, because it would relieve, if nothing else, the psychological pressure on the Cambodian people. But I don't believe he is captured. I don't believe he is he's being held anywhere. The source for this story was Prince Ranarid himself. And undoubtedly what Ranarid wanted to do was to bring in to Phnom Penh, to bring in to Cambodia, his old allies in this coalition I described, the Khmer Rouge, who are out there in the forests and up near the western border near Thailand. He wanted to bring those in order to bolster his own flagging political apparatus against Hun Sen. Now, that didn't work. I mean, he's an inept politician for a start. It just didn't work. The Khmer Rouge, however, which hasn't come out, remarkably, seeing we had all those lurid stories about Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge are back in Phnom Penh. My sources are that they've infiltrated all over Phnom Penh. They're in the cities and towns. And who knows what they'll do or what coalitions they will forge now, but they remain a force in that country. They're not defeated. That has been the kind of Western wishful thinking, otherwise known as propaganda, in order to justify this UN so-called peace operation a couple of years ago. They're still very much a player in that country. Depleted, yes, but a player. The state of awareness of Cambodia has always been pretty terrible. I think it's probably worse than ever at the moment.
We're talking to John Pilger, an internationally renowned filmmaker, did a number of films on Cambodia, also did a film on Indonesia, a country we were just talking about a little while ago because of the campaign finance abuse hearings that are taking place in Washington, D.C., with a special focus on the U.S. government relationship with the Indonesian military dictator Suharto. John Pilger did a film on Indonesia's occupation of East Timor called Death of a Nation. And I wanted to ask you, John, any parallels you see between the U.S. relationship with Cambodia and the U.S. relationship with Indonesia? I mean, we're talking about, in both cases, some of the worst genocides of the 20th century.
Well, yes, of course. The thread is the same. It's there. I mean, you can extend it all over the world through Central America and wherever else that U.S. power is applied, East Timor is probably one of the most gruesome examples. It's a terrible example because here was a little country, a Portuguese colony. It was overrun by the Indonesian forces. The Indonesia was condemned by the Security Council. Today, it's still an illegal occupation. All this was done with the connivance of the U.S. Then the Ford administration, with our friend Mr. Kissinger, deeply involved in it. Again, you look at some of the files of. Particularly to do with Kissinger, his role is quite central to ensuring that American arms went to Indonesia at the time of the takeover in East Timor. I interviewed former CIA officer Philip Lichty in Washington in my film, who described very vividly the way that U.S. war material went straight to East Timor. So the U.S. was an accessory in the invasion of this country, which, according to multiple sources now, resulted in the deaths of a third of the population, at least 200,000 people, and like the numbers in Cambodia, actually, it's probably going to end up a lot more. Because Indonesia, described by President Nixon as a great prize, and it still is, it's a great market, and it's also a source of cheap labor, particularly for U.S. products, and all the reasons are there. So, Cambodia is a much more distressed country perhaps than Indonesia itself. East Timor, of course, is not part of Indonesia, although it's occupied by Indonesia. Cambodia is so stricken by and traumatized by an almost endless period of intervention and violence since the late 60s that it needs a great deal of help, but not the kind of help it's getting at the moment.
Well, John Pilger, I want to thank you very much for joining us from London. John Pilger, journalist, filmmaker based in Britain. That latest film, Death of a Nation, The Timor Conspiracy, is available through the East Timor Action Network, and you can call them at 914-428-7299. That's 914-428-7299. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can order a cassette copy by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can write to us. We'd love to hear from you by email. We're at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Or you can call us on our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. We play some of those comments on Democracy Now! From time to time. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. When we come back, we're going to take a look at conservative foundations and their influence on the public policy debate in this country. Again, we've been speaking with John Pilger, British filmmaker, has done a series of films on Cambodia as well as Indonesia. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. A dozen politically conservative foundations spent $210 million in a three-year period on efforts to reshape national policy debates and push Congress and state legislatures around the country to the right. This according to a new study released by the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, which is a watchdog group that serves as an advocate for the poor. Joining us now is its Director of Democracy and Philanthropy, Sally Covington, speaking to us from New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sally.
Thank you for having me.
Sally, what are these foundations and who are they funding?
We decided to examine 12 ideologically conservative foundations. Some of the leading foundations in that group include the John Olin Foundation, the Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation, the trio of Koch family foundations, the Smith Richardson Foundation, and others. Now, what we found in this, in seeing that they awarded $210 million to a conservative policy and advocacy infrastructure, is that they are starting with a very clear political vision, and they are funding an ideological agenda. That was a finding of our research. The grants data show that these funders awarded that $210 million to grantees that are unabashed in their support of unregulated markets and limited government and are pushing in various policy arenas and issue areas with an effort to promote deregulation, privatization of government services, government retrenchment or deep reductions in anti-poverty spending, and also pushing for the transfer of social welfare responsibilities from federal government to the charitable sector. One of the strategies of these conservative funders is that they're really multiplying the number of institutional voices at all levels of government that are carrying the same core set of policy messages. And they're building incredibly strong institutions, awarding unrestricted money to institutions like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, Citizens for a Sound Economy, Free Congress Research and Education Foundation. Those five institutions alone received close to $30 million from just 12 grant makers over the three-year period that we looked at. Now, that's tremendous capitalization of these policy institutions that are aggressively engaged in moving a public policy agenda for the country, forward for the country. We were curious to see what their combined revenue base was for 1995 and found that they operated on a total combined revenue base of $79 million for 1995. We were also curious curious about the revenue base of sort of progressive equivalents, policy institutions that are promoting a progressive policy agenda. It was hard, by the way, to identify progressive equivalents, by which we meant or mean multi-issue policy institutions focused on national, domestic, and foreign policy. What we came up with, however, was the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the Institute for Policy Studies, the Economic Policy Institute, and Citizens for Tax Justice. Those four groups operated on a combined revenue base of $9 million. So you have $79 million on the one hand supporting right-of-center policy institutions and $9 million on the other in this particular sample. We think there's a significant funding gap going on that has a lot of implications for the kinds of policies that are put forward for public discussion and action.
Who are the families behind these?
We know certain things. For example, the trio of Koch family foundations that we examined come from the Koch family empire, which is based the empire was created through the oil industry or oil money in Oklahoma.
They're very close to Bob Dole, aren't they? That's Koch as in K-O-C-H.
K-O-C-H, that's right. And they've been big contributors to conservative policy institutions for quite a while, big backers of the Cato Institute, for example. The Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation was a relatively small foundation until Rockwell International bought out the Bradley Company in the mid-1980s, and then its assets mushroomed.
Let's talk about some of the academic institutions that these conservative foundations support.
Of the $210 million, we found that roughly approximately $90 million was targeted to academic institutions of higher education across the country. It was not, however, awarded as sort of open, unrestricted grants to institutions like Yale or Stanford or Harvard or the University of Chicago. It was carefully targeted to help build an intellectual edifice for conservative policy positions. Substantial amounts of that $90 million went to support and expand a conservative law and economics curriculum in the nation's major law schools, so the efforts to train the next generation of legal scholars and practitioners, orienting them to the use of efficiency principles in the practice of law. There was support for conservative academic or policy research institutes, conservative scholars, fellowships to support students in the study of free market economics, internship opportunities supported by these funders to move students along into summer internships where they're placed in some of the think tanks and media outlets that are supported by the foundations. And in addition, there was tremendous investment in conservative student and faculty networks to try and oppose progressive or non-traditional curriculum trends, affirmative action trends in higher education.
You list the top academic sector grantee institution as the University of Chicago, receiving more than $10 million, which is perhaps no surprise to a lot of people, since that is really the center of conservative economic thinking with people like Friedman and others, and they are free market philosophies. Then you go to Harvard University at $9.6 million, George Mason University, Yale, Claremont McKenna College, down to Boston, Cornell, Stanford, Georgetown, NYU, New York University, University of California, Berkeley, receiving $830,000. Are these foundations endowing chairs that they would insist, for example, go to a conservative professor?
They are endowing chairs, and that's providing significant support. You know, one of the things that we say they are doing is creating and cultivating public intellectuals and policy leaders for the conservative movement. And so a number of well-known conservative faculty members, as well as conservative public officials like Bill Bennett, for example, have been heavily funded for their work so that they can maintain public visibility and influence.
You know, it's interesting with someone like Bill Bennett and a lot of people that you see on television. I was going to say a lot of these white guys you see on television. You wonder, what do they do? What is their financial support? Because all you do is see them on television.
Well, often they are linked to some of the think tanks or advocacy organizations such as the Heritage Foundation and American Enterprise Institute, and they are provided support, or these conservative funders are establishing senior fellowship positions at some of their grantee institutions, and then Bill Bennett will be a senior fellow at a particular institution and funded heavily. And so they're creating institutional platforms for conservative thinkers and leaders in the country in a way that has been very effective in keeping these people in the public eye.
You have a section in your report, Moving a Public Policy Agenda, the Strategic Philanthropy of Conservative Foundations, a special box on sponsoring conservative minorities. And you have a picture of Thomas Sowell there.
Yes. Well, we have found that there has been a fairly significant effort to mobilize conservative voices within communities of color. The Institute for Contemporary Studies, which is San Francisco-based, for example, it was created by Caspar Weinberger and Edwin Meese back in the 1980s, and it was an organization that convened the first National Conference of Black Conservatives. And since then, they have been generously funding conservatives of color to promote anti-affirmative action positions, to be critical of social welfare policies in the country and the like. They have been also funding new institutions such as the Center for Black Leadership in Washington, D.C., and just working to sort of mainstream the views of conservatives of color as a part of an overall effort to move a particular policy agenda forward.
You say Thomas Sowell, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and author of numerous books attacking welfare state policies. He became well known for his friendship with now Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. You also list Walter Williams, John Olin, distinguished professor of economics at George Mason University, who's also a senior fellow at both the Heritage Foundation and the Hoover Institution, Robert Woodson, founder of the well-funded Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, who's consistently opposed federal anti-poverty initiatives as reinforcing dependency, and was an advisor to Congressman Newt Gingrich in 1996, Glenn Lowry, now teaching at Boston University, who disdains the civil rights movement, blames social disorganization of blacks manifested in high rates of teenage pregnancy, etc. Alan Keyes, most recently a GOP presidential candidate, whose extreme views have placed him in as a regular on Free Congress Foundation's National Empowerment Television and as a favorite on the conservative lecture circuit. And you list a number of groups like the Alternative Black Speakers Project from Young America's Foundation, as well as the National Council for Public Policy Research, the National Institute for Traditional Black Leadership, and the Minnesota Network for Conservative Black Leadership.
That's right. So you can see there's been a tremendous effort to cultivate conservative viewpoints among a minority of particularly African Americans, but also other people of color. Linda Chavez, for example, has been supported, who, of course, was on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission appointed by Reagan, President Reagan, and she now heads the Center for Equal Opportunity in Washington, which is a conservative group that has also been financed by these conservative foundations. So there's been a significant effort to cultivate this group of individuals.
And Dinesh D'Souza.
And Dinesh D'Souza, who, of course, wrote The End of Racism and was a fellow, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and in fact was a student at, I believe it was Dartmouth University, and was is a prime example of the way in which these conservative funders have provided the resources and helped to create a very effective sort of leadership pipeline to bring conservatives along, so that he was supported, his paper at Dartmouth was supported by conservative funders. He became a junior policy analyst at some of these conservative institutions and sort of is moved up and on as a conservative spokesperson.
We're talking to Sally Covington, who's head of Democracy and Philanthropy at the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy. Well, being from a media organization, what about media groups and foundation funding, conservative foundation support for media outlets?
Well, certainly we have found that these conservative funders have not ignored media. In fact, they have understood absolutely, as I said earlier, the importance of persuasive communications. And as part of a broad effort to market a political agenda and a policy agenda, they provided over $16 million to finance alternative media outlets such as the American Spectator, the Public Interest, the National Interest. They are also funding media watchdog groups to try and criticize the kinds of coverage, cultural programming and news coverage that appears on public television, radio, as well as on the commercial stations.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because PBS is often attacked as being liberal, and yet you point out that these foundations, conservative foundations, do fund a number of programs on PBS.
Yes, they have been providing about a third of that $16 million went to support specific programming on public television. And that has varied. I mean, they support think tanks, Ben Wattenberg's program, think tanks on public television. So when they are targeting money to support to PBS, it's not unrestricted. It's for particular shows that are supportive of conservative philosophical principles and policy views.
I think it's interesting that you have on PBS, for example, William Buckley's Firing Line, which is supported by conservative foundations, as you said, Ben Wattenberg's think tank, Peggy Noonan on Values, the speechwriter for Bush, and also before that for Reagan, and other conservative news analysis shows. Yet you also have PBS refusing labor money support.
It seems that the attacks coming from the right on PBS have really had an effect, an intimidating effect on PBS, and has been quite successful in getting PBS to include and or broaden even further its conservative or right-of-center public affairs reporting or programming.
What about legal groups?
These conservative foundations, and again, it's very, it's quite strategic that they are spreading their money across almost every major strategic sector of American society to build support for a conservative policy agenda. So in addition to funding media, in addition to funding national think tanks, in addition to funding state think tanks, they are also funding pro-market, often very heavily business-sponsored law firms and other law-related projects or organizations. They gave just over $10 million to help develop groups like the Institute for Justice, the Pacific Legal Foundation, and other litigation organizations that are working to reverse affirmative action in the country, that are working to roll back environmental protection laws and the regulatory framework to protect the environment, that are working to oppose or reverse rent control statutes and the like. In fact, over the past two decades, there's been the development of this new infrastructure of conservative public interest law firms that are really working to redefine the very idea of public interest law, which historically, of course, has sought to remove discriminatory barriers to the participation of communities of color, and so forth. So this has been a development that the conservative, the development of institutions that conservative funders have been integrally involved with.
Well, Sally Covington, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, she is with the National Committee for Responsible Philanthropy, Responsive Philanthropy, and their report is called Moving a Public Policy Agenda, the Strategic Philanthropy of Conservative Foundations. And if you'd like to get a hold of a copy of this, you can call in Washington, D.C., 202-387-9177. That's 202-387-9177. And if you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's Democracy Now!, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We welcome your email at democracy@pacifica.org. We are on Real Audio on the web. You can listen to the show anytime you want or tell friends who don't get a chance to hear Democracy Now! On their public radio station, either to call the station and tell them to run Democracy Now!, or they can go to the web at www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland, our New York engineer. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Thanks also to Joe Gill. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!